Good evening, everybody. Thank you for joining us and giving up your 10 o'clock hour on this Friday. My name is Amy Stepanovich. I am U.S. Policy Manager. If you click on top of this mic, at Access Now, which is an international organization. We work on issues involving human rights and tech. And I'm moderating the panel today because about 6 years ago, I'm in a friend's apartment with about seven other people, and we were watching a British comedy series, as you do, probably on a Saturday night, because I'm super cool, guys. And at one point, somebody looked up and they were like, did you hear about this new internet-connected sex toy? We had to do something with the plot line. And I was like, what are you talking about? Are you kidding? They're actually connecting those? And I read about it, and I brought it to work, and I was like, this is going to be a big issue, guys. We should work on this. And because I work in Washington, D.C., they all kind of looked at me sideways, wondered, what is Amy talking about crazy like again, and promptly ignored me. Which is what they've been doing every time I've brought up that subject since. Cheers. The problem is, this year, a multi-million-dollar fine was levied against a company that created an internet-connected sex toy because that company was collecting way too much information. Think of every single type of information, basically, that a connected sex toy might collect, and they were collecting it. They also could prove that that sex toy was hackable. And so a Canadian regulatory agency levied a fine against that company, and all of a sudden, people started to pay attention. Now, it's still sex, and I still work in Washington, D.C., so everybody still looks at me a little bit sideways when I bring this topic up, but it's increasingly something that people are thinking about and talking about, and we're going to explore some of the legal and policy and security implications of that. We're going to try to talk up here as little as possible and go to the floor because I'm already seeing hands in the back of the room, which is a really good start. I am taking note of that, so we will get there. Real quick, I'm going to give the panelists a quick moment to introduce themselves, then we're going to give kind of short framing remarks for you and turn it over to questions. So start with Jim, and then we'll just go down the line.
My name is Jim Nettles. I have about 30 years of working in technology, both business development, emerging technologies, consulting in these fields, big data, e-commerce. I've worked with a number of startups over the years. Part of my background also involves me working with liability, insurance, a lot of this side of thing with both product liability as well as what you find with medical liability. And I've also had a great deal of fun speaking about privacy, current privacy rights, where things stand from a privacy perspective. I'm also a science fiction and fantasy author as well as a nonfiction author, so I get to go play with really fun topics in fiction from more of a development perspective.
Is this from the sex toys?
Come on in!
Yes. You're in the right
place. But you're late, so you have to bring the panelists a drink.
I have whiskey on me.
I have beer.
Just be
too festive.
Yeah. So
this is typically the
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And I'm coming so into this excited. Panel is largely, you know, we talk about, or we don't talk about sex because of so many of the taboo issues that go on around it. However, if you look at what we do from a business standpoint, sex drives everything. And because it is such a taboo subject, and because everything that goes on from a privacy standpoint, a data standpoint, what we see around us every day, we're afraid to talk about something that potentially is something that can be used against us because of these taboo subjects. And because I am such a believer in privacy, because I am such a believer in these sorts of things, we at least need to be educated and make decisions well about the products and services we use, because we as consumers are the ones that are going to define that, and if we don't, then industry will define it for us.
Adrian?
I'm Adrian McDonald. I am a performance coach, and most of the work I do in my practice is around belief systems with God, sex, and money, the holy trinity of taboo subjects. Prior to doing that, I coach around God, sex, and money. Everybody heard that? Prior to doing that, I was in IT. for about 20 years. So I've got a little bit of both sides of the house. So that's my background.
I'm Meredith Rose. I work at a group called Public Knowledge. We're a tech policy consumer advocacy organization in D.C. So I, like Amy, am a creature of D.C. I deal a lot with, the way I sort of got into this was I deal a lot with the FCC, and last year there was a proceeding about privacy around privacy rules that would have governed how internet service providers use your data that they collect. And we talk about a lot about the Internet of Things, just as a tech policy shop, that's kind of the new frontier of a lot of different things that we work on. And so one of my colleagues and I would banter around the idea about like, what is the absolute worst case scenario for the most invasive IoT thing you could possibly have? It would be a connected sex toy. And we laughed about it, and kind of bantered it back and forth, and then the Wii Vibe lawsuit happened, which is a lawsuit about a IoT-enabled vibrator that collected too much data. And I literally like burst into my colleague's office and I was like, it's happening! And this just led to 10 solid minutes of everyone standing in the hallway making really dirty puns about pulling out of the lawsuit. It was ridiculous. And so I kind of come at it from the perspective of privacy and how that interacts with like your broadband providers and other kind of aspects of that.
So before I start asking questions, I should have started with this. Forgive me. This is Dragon Con After Dark. So because we're talking about sex, just the rules, be good, be respectful, be accepting. I don't want to say this is a safe space because we really want to challenge ideas and notions and preconceptions, but I want it to be a harassment and judgment-free space, if at all possible. So if you guys can help me with that, that would be wonderful. And with that, I'm going to start by turning to Meredith and ask her looking at Internet of Things, the IoT space. Anybody from DC likes talking in acronyms. So if either of us use an acronym you don't understand, raise your hand and I will know what you're talking about and we'll try to fix that. So looking at IoT generally, what are the legal issues and what are the rules out there? Are there rules out there guiding what can be collected, what can be connected?
Short answer is no, there are no rules. Right now, it's kind of the Wild West. Essentially, what your smart sex toy can and cannot collect is entirely up to the manufacturer. They would argue between you and the manufacturer because you sign off on a contract when you open the box, which I think we all know is kind of a convenient fiction that they like to throw around. There was a proceeding that happened, and I mentioned this earlier, that started last year where, and this was all kind of spiraling out of the Title II net neutrality classification, which if anyone was here earlier today, around 5:30, we had a whole panel about net neutrality. The very short version is that Title II services, which the internet is currently considered a Title II service, it might not be in a few months if the current FCC has its way, there are certain privacy obligations that attach to those services about what they can and cannot do with the data that you as a customer must give them in order for your service to function. So if you go back to like the days of where we were all just using landline telephones, your telephone service provider, you had to, in order to get to use your telephone, you had to send them, they had to collect certain kinds of data. They had to collect what number is initiating the call, what number is receiving the call, the time of the call, and the duration of the call, as well as any kind of internal routing information. And that was stuff that they just had to have in order for it to function. And that's a pretty simple system. But when you start looking at broadband and internet connections, come on in, we don't fight. Let's get to that kind of thing. So when you look at your broadband internet service provider, so let's just say you've got Verizon. Verizon will not only need sort of the IP address that you are, the IP address that basically routes your packet. It needs the basic volume of the packet, like kind of where the packet's going. It gets somewhat analogous information. The problem is that you can determine a lot. So when you call a phone number, especially in the days of landline telephones before everyone had a cell phone in their pocket and had their own number, when you called a phone number, phone company didn't know who was picking up. like, they knew who the number was registered to. That could be a house of, you know, a house of a family of five. It could be a medical practice where any number of people could be answering. They don't know who's actually picking up. When you're dealing with IP routing and when you're dealing with URLs, which a lot of connected devices, so like your smart refrigerator is the other example, when that needs a software update, that will often push to a URL that is something like deviceupdate.samsungfridge.com. And you can tell just by looking at that URL exactly what is calling that URL. There's no reason for you from your laptop to go to like refrigeratordeviceupdate.samsung.com. It's got to be a smart refrigerator. And so when you have these software updates coming from a connected vibrator, for instance, you know, you have like softwareupdate.wevibe.com. I wonder where that could possibly be going and what could possibly be sending that request. So now Comcast knows you own a connected vibrator, approximately how often you're using it. They can monitor the traffic coming from certain, you know, depending on what kind of stuff it's actually broadcasting. So that's just from the ISP's perspective. That's not even counting, like, if your thing is hackable, then, like, just a random individual who decides that they want to hack your vibrator, which is a thing, can collect all kinds of data. I do highly recommend that I will plug this right off the bat because it's a great blog, The Internet of Dongs. I'm not kidding. The URL is internetofdon.gs. Wins award for best URL. It's sponsored by Pornhub. And all they do is check the security of sex toys. That's their entire shtick. So if this is something that really interests you, further reading when you get home, check it out.
It's an awesome,
awesome blog. So that's kind of like, those are some of the general like legal issues surrounding, on a regulatory level, surrounding sex toys. And then you get into things like, well, you know, say you have a set of paired vibrators for like a long distance relationship, or you know, your partner is in Atlanta and you're in DC and you decide to have a session together and your partner surprises you by, you know, initiating this vibrator at night and you think like, oh, well, that was kind of a sweet romantic surprise. And then all of a sudden you find out your partner did not initiate that session. You don't know who did. That all of a sudden on a like a very basic first year law school concept went from something that's totally okay to like, was that sexual assault? Was that rape? Like, if it was uninvited by some random person that you can't identify. So there's all kinds of like, you can really go down the hypothetical sort of rabbit hole with a lot of the legal issues there.
And one of the concerning things is Congress nor the courts know if that is rape or sexual harassment, and it could vary from state to state, from country to country, and we could get a lot of really different things, and if it's badly interpreted, a lot of really bad law that comes out of it, if it's not considered early. Is a question, or did I use a term you don't understand?
Just a quick question. What about the AES encryption when it comes to connecting that's happening?
So we're going to get to a security question in just a second, and I'm going to tee that up for Jim when I ask him about security. And probably after I ask Jim first, what is in the Internet of Sex Toy space? Like, before we talk about the security of the devices, can you talk to us about what devices exist, and then we'll get into the security implications a little bit.
Well, the first thing I'd say is, how do we define what a sex toy is? You know, there's the obvious. There's an internet-connected vibrator. We're talking about that. Here's my next question. Is this a sex toy?
Yes.
I can take usage. I can use this for video. Nanny cams. There's a lot of things out there, so how we define things as a sex toy is going to be really dependent on the usage. And so when we talk about legislation and how these things are happening, it's not so much about, is it involving sex? The number one question is it a violation of my personal privacy? Is it a violation of what's going on? And as we look at the evolution of technologies that are coming out, we're a much more connected world than we were 6 months ago, a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So as that develops and the technologies that are out there, you know, we're looking at a very rapid expansion of technologies, protocols, as we build out this entire world, and as sex is such a key driver to humanity and any living species, you know, we go, it's not only for procreation for the human species, there's enjoyment, there's connections, there's a lot of social implications. So we're going to go and build out toys that amplify that in a lot of different ways. And if we look at things sociologically, how we've done it over historically, if it's something I can play with and something I can explore, somebody's going to do it. And you know, if we look at the core senses, sensory of touch, sensory of smell, sensory of sound, sensory of sight, all of those are things that we can accomplish with off-the-shelf technology today. So when we talk about this and we look at something like the Real Dolls sitting on the shelf, I mean, those have been around now for what, 20 years? Ballpark, let's say 20, 25 years that are go ahead.
Real Dolls.
Real Dolls, if you don't know what they are, they're a very lifelike, in certain respects, physically in size, mass, weight. You can order them to your own custom specs. Tomorrow night we'll actually be talking kind of the future of sex tech. And one of those things that's coming out of that is they're now incorporating AIs into those with different settings, different personalities.
It's a Buffy bot.
And you know, we're not yet into Blade Runner and that level of hooker bot, but you know, we're getting there. But when we go and talk about technology and sex, we become very embarrassed about the taboos of how we use technology off the shelf to start with. About a year and a half ago, StonerCon in Boston, and for entertainment value, one of the few panels that we actually went to was sex from Home Depot, basically. It was home-built sex. And it was all about building different devices in your home and all this sort of stuff. It was like, well, this ought to be interesting. It was being run by an engineer. We knew the people are, you know. And we went into it, and I've not fallen asleep in a panel that fast in a very long time. But because it really was not, it was not experimental. It was not exploring what we can do. And so as we talk about what's available today, it's we have a mass of devices at our fingertips that can be used not only for any sort of personal social interaction, but also for very personal social interaction. And while it develops and builds connections we have, I used to travel 48 weeks a year or more professionally. I was all over the planet. Having some way to connect back to those people that I love and care about was very critical. For people that are in that industry, and that do these sorts of things, you have to have the ability to stay connected. And, you know, that's what it is. It's not about just necessarily something that was built by, you know, Pornhub or something along those lines, but the other side of it becomes, we have to remember one number one thing. If it's connected to the internet and data is being sent somewhere, and somebody's collecting that data.
So as an interlude, before we come back to you on security, Adrian, you know, Jim kind of teased how these are used. Can you talk about how they're used and how, like, there are actual medical uses for these devices?
Yes, I mean, I actually own the one that was hacked and there was a lawsuit about, so I'll just go ahead and say that. And the
closer to the mic, please.
I actually own the device that was hacked. And most of the ones that I've seen out there are female vibrators. They are starting to have the kinds that are paired, one male, one female, so that you can have the connection between you and your lover at the time. And you're seeing sex therapists recommend some of these devices so that people can learn their bodies more. In the beginning, it was just you can do the app and there's also a remote control. And people would ask me, well, why would I download the app? Well, the companies that are developing these devices incentivize you by putting different settings on the app that you can't get on the remote control. So you're like, oh, well, and they're usually the more creative ones, right? So they're like, oh, come.
And we're done.
Come to the right? So, and there are a lot of female founders that are now going into this industry because there is a boatload of money to be made in the sex industry. I think the U.S. alone spent $3 million on sex toys in 2015, and it was rapidly increasing.
Billion or billion?
Three million, just in the U.S. And there's a lot of.
But I think that again, defines is determined by defining a sex toy.
And I think that was mostly vibrators, if I remember the research correctly. But a lot of the women are getting into this because in the beginning, the vibrators were not ergonomically friendly to women, right? So, they wanted a little bit more a pleasure. So now they've got vibrators that will track your temperature, your pelvic floor movements, your intensity levels of your orgasms, and their track that data is back into the app so that you can graph your orgasms. Right? So, and people are like, okay, so why would I want to do that? Well, from a sex education standpoint, if you're working with a therapist trying to, if you've never had an orgasm before, and trust me, there are a lot of people out there that have not, it helps the therapist sort of pinpoint where some of your opportunities for improvement are, okay? But also, you know, just learning your own body. And again, this is something that we don't like to talk about, so it's very private, you know, don't you want to have sex better, but you're not sure, you know, this type of thing. So that's where I'm seeing a lot of that happen. But they're getting a lot more sophisticated. And the data, the one about the pelvic floor and the movements and whatnot, that really threw me. And now there's actually one out there with a camera. And if I'm not mistaken, the camera's already been proven to be hacked. That one is coming out of China, a sex toy developer out of China. So it's and of course people are embarrassed when they came out with the WeVibe lawsuit. It's like, oh, yes, I own that, but I don't want to tell anybody I own that because they don't want to have the conversation. So those are the types of people that I'm seeing that are doing that, the reasons.
If you're interested in the camera one, we actually, AccessNow filed a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission over this specific device, and we give the history in it. There is also a really good article on the Internet of Dongs pre-mentioned website that talks about why some of the security vulnerabilities might have been overblown. I encourage you to read both sides because I think more information is always better. Let's talk real quick to Jim about security, and then I'm going to go to the audience for questions. If you want to raise your hand, I will try to memorize anybody who starts raising their hand now. I make no promises, though, because if 50 hands go up, I'm going to be confused.
So from a security standpoint, I'm going to talk initially about just the general Internet of Things, and security is what I'm going to call negligible. And largely this is because it is an investment by the providers where they don't want to spend money because they don't see an immediate ROI. There have not been enough lawsuits, there have not been enough complaints, and the market has not come down and slammed on them and said, fuck no, you need to provide what we ask for from privacy and security.
Jim, we had a hand go up, I think, for ROI.
Return on investment. Sorry. So in other words, the money's not there. It has not cost these people enough that are providing the services. And I openly admit, working in organizations where we calculate return on investment versus risk, I've done this my entire career. So when you calculate this, it is, what is the benefit, what is the turnover for security and data? Text from the audience. Anyway, so yes, I'll work that in. But anyway, from a security standpoint, the sex industry almost, and these devices almost depend on you not reporting violations from an embarrassment standpoint. But the same thing is true with money. Now, we'll call and raise hell about a $5 service charge. And so, if you look at, I'm going to throw something out there, hotel charges, and the number of porns that are rented in a hotel from business travelers. As a general rule, if you look, hotels will go and go out there and label, not label the movie. They'll just label something on there so that hotel, you know, when they go to get reimbursed by clients and whatnot, that's not a problem. We as a society have well hidden these sorts of things. So when you ask about security, we have technologies and protocols that are out there. There is nothing that is not hackable. We just spent an hour talking about self-driving cars and hackability of that. Privacy is dead. We're operating in a new world of privacy. And it's in a world which we don't pay attention to the potential vulnerabilities. And so when we talk about the hacking of the vibrators, when we talk about breaching that security, we're operating on very low levels of protocols. The actual level of encryption we use, this data, there's no incentive for the vendors to provide what they should be doing.
Did you want to say a word about AES?
So,
real quick, so
the short answer is, it depends on the provider. There are not enough devices in the field yet, so that there's not become an industry standard. I mean, sure.
So, is it possible to have a kind of a...
Wait, hold on a sec.
Yeah, hold on 1 second. So while she's coming over there, here's the part I'll add. As a general rule of Internet of Things, if you look at the number of things out there, like the websites that go out and tell you the protocols to hack a nanny cam, and the number of places that go out there and harass infants out there based on nanny cams, you can go out and with a very minimal amount of research, and you can go start scouting who's not got their stuff locked down because they didn't change a password. The majority of it is not because the majority of security is not because there's not availability. It's because we don't do it as the individuals that are responsible for making the changes we need to.
Yeah. I guess adding on to that particular question is that my wife's actually a sex therapist, and she's getting a doctorate in that, and I'm working to invent certain things involving this particular thing, such as the point-to-point encryption, AES encryption, and the like. I was wondering about the industry standard like BIOS and the like. Is that, in your opinion, going to be something that the consumer is going to have access to, or is that not something that the average consumer would even be able to start to get?
I am hoping, especially with these ladies on the two ends, that we're going to be able to advocate to get better industry standards across the board for the Internet of Things as a whole. Because I don't believe we have anywhere near the level of accountability from providers, and I don't believe we have set those standards as a technology yet. I mean, if I can go driving down the road and hack people's Bluetooth headsets and listen to them driving down the road. There's nothing to cracking the majority of these technologies.
So there was a question all the way at the back, right at the very, very beginning of the panel. Do you still have the question?
Go ahead, Neil. You've got a question.
No. I just wanted to make sure. There were two up here, one in the second row and one in the first row that I saw. And then anybody on? Okay, we're going to kind of see our way back toward this side. And then we'll hit this side on the way back up. Does that?
Okay, so I'm actually representing the Internet of Dongs right now. And so the one thing we've been seeing a lot is it's not even an ROI issue right now. It's a lot of these companies don't even have IT security people.
That's
so
correct.
In addition to
talking to it.
So not even like trying to set a standard, but has anyone done anything like I am the cavalry, but they're just trying to talk to these companies and tell them like you need IT security?
I know, I mean, again, if you're representing Internet of Dongs, this is is old news, but they actually, I think the practice there is to contact the manufacturers. This is for folks who have not read the blog. The practice is to, when they find a vulnerability, first go straight to the manufacturers. And this includes vulnerabilities in their site certificates and like login encryption and just you name it. They play with all aspects of the product and the services that go with it. They've had been stonewalled by a couple of different manufacturers. And so they actually have like a, there's a report card on their website that has like, you know, before we contacted them and then after we, like 2 weeks after we contacted them, that you can see like going from an F to an A minus and blah, blah, blah. So that's my very limited understanding of standard practices.
I think that you bring up a good point. There are so many of these organizations that don't, it's like there's a lack of awareness there. A lack of awareness and a lack of skill set to deal with that. When I've gone to several sexuality conferences, this is not something that's discussed. So there's a big disconnect between sex educators, sex providers, and the technology industry. And it's like we need to get these people together to do the education that he was talking about and raise the level of awareness of, no, you really need to do this. The vibrating company, the developer of the vibrator company that was doing the more sensory stuff, because of the lawsuit with WeVibe, made the decision of, yes, they have told their consumer base, we are tracking this data, we have built a warehouse around it, but we have stripped out all the personal information. When we look at it, it's all anonymous and whatnot. Would they have done that without that lawsuit? Who knows, right? But it's that particular lawsuit has driven some of the manufacturers, at least, to take a more proactive approach, but probably not to the level that they need to because of that whole just lack of knowledge.
So, and I'll add this on top. I've worked in a lot of different businesses. I've worked in, and I've consulted for a lot of different industries, from very small to very large. And it's not just the idea of sex toys. It is across the board with the companies you do business with every day. I mean, the amount of data we give away. Security protocols are available that will enhance security. We're not doing our part as consumers, and providers are not doing their part because there's not necessarily been the impetus behind it. It is when there's a data breach, there's a lawsuit that comes in and says, you were responsible because you should have held up your end of the bargain. I mean, if you look at, I'm gonna throw this out there, on the other side with money again, because this is the other big taboo subject, data aggregators. People, you know, for a while there's a big Wild West of people going out there and plugging in their bank accounts, their investment accounts, all this stuff in these fun aggregator accounts, and giving away the keys to their personal kingdom. And the data security on some of these companies was atrocious. And I don't use that word lightly. I mean the data breaches that went on a regular basis. There is no one in this room, because I feel sure everyone here has been on the internet. All of your data is out there. It's just a matter of nobody's come to you yet. Oh, and by the way, if you're not paranoid by the time I'm done, I haven't done my job.
So I'm going to throw this out here just because there's a lot of questions, and I should have done it before anybody started, but I'm going to do it now. When you get to ask a question, try to keep it to 30 seconds, and at the end of that question, your voice should go up as if you are asking a question and not ending on a period and making a statement.
And
as a general rule. Go ahead.
Okay, so... Well, I was just going to mention that, like, literally everything we do in the age of the internet is tracked. Like, all the websites, our history, our cookies, our IP address, what devices we're accessing it from, and all that. So, like, why should we care more about how many times we turn our vibrator on and, like, what's happening with that than, like, our credit card information and all that that's already tracked? I mean, is this a much bigger issue that's being considered, or do people just think they're equal? Like, just trying to figure out what the difference is and the concern levels.
I think part of it is you have to kind of look at like consumer psychology. I think the group that we have assembled in this room and is probably more savvy than your average internet user. And by virtue of the fact that you're here, that means you do care about privacy concerns because it's like, you know, baked into the title of the panel. But I think people who don't spend a lot of time thinking about this, I think that there is a way of looking at the internet, which I think is a valid one, and I actually generally subscribe to, which is that to some extent, we expect privacy to be there and be invisible. We are still operating on the assumptions of privacy that we built around living in an analog world, that, you know, people don't know where you live unless they follow you home, that people, or you tell them, that people don't know your phone number unless you give it to them, that people don't know what church you go to unless they go to your church or you tell them. That is no longer the case, and to some extent, I think you're right, it's just we're operating on outdated thinking. At the same time, you know, part of what we talk about is that there, and the FTC has recognized this, that there are certain kinds of information that are just deeply sensitive. The Supreme Court has weighed in on this, that there are certain kinds of information, like health information. That's why we have HIPAA, which is we just come to this acknowledgement that some data is more valuable than others. And even though it may all be out there, if we can't control the fact that it's out there, maybe we can control what people actually do with it at the end of the day.
As the policy privacy person professional on this panel, I will add, just because that stuff is collected now doesn't mean it should be, and it doesn't mean that you shouldn't care that that stuff is collected, in addition to caring about if your sex information is collected. And I actually think that we're, in a way, slingshotting back. Europe just passed an incredibly comprehensive privacy law that applies to all of the different countries within the European Union. That will have impacts felt in the US, where companies will better protect your privacy because of what they have to do in Europe. We're starting to see companies have to restrict what data they collect. And so I wouldn't not care about what they're collecting just because they're collecting it now. I would care more, and I would be loud. And if there are other types of information you don't think companies should be collecting, I would be louder. And I would say that.
The only thing I would add to that is sociologically and generationally, we have gradation about people that care about privacy. And as the younger you are, the less privacy conscious people tend to be. Because we've grown up in an age of not knowing, not caring, and being aware of, I share everything here. The question is, what can somebody do with that data? You know, what can somebody do with the information about you? Because we collect information about everyone. The amount of information that is available about you through a variety of services and what gets used is largely to sell to you. It's used to market to you. So sharing the data may not be a bad thing. It may give you opportunities to get to other opportunities that you don't currently have. But you should have that ability to make that conscious decision.
So I get why customers and people using these devices might care about how their data is used and think about it separately from other connected devices. But why are you guys as policymakers thinking this any differently? Because if this gentleman down the front, say, wants to make a serverless architecture to have connected devices where there is no way to know other than that you're sending TCP packets over an SSL socket, they can. But why is the policy any different on these devices from, say, my NannyCam or my Facebook or my Square Cash readings?
You just hit the golden ticket. It shouldn't be. It should be the lowest common denominator. We have a right to privacy in this country. Not necessarily everywhere in the world, but in this country, we have a right to privacy. We have a right to a lot of things. We give it away through the services we use for convenience. So you just hit the golden answer. While we're here to talk about sex toys and while we're here to talk about internet security, the core of it really is not about sex. That's a great salacious way to get everybody in here to hear a core topic, which is, do you care about your privacy? And I can tell you there's a large number of people that don't. They just give it away and they don't see the fact of what is going on.
So I'll piggyback on this. There is a really large, so again, I'm gonna put on my lawyer hat, a large swath of the law functions on this idea, which, you know, arguably made a lot of sense back in 1809 and does not make so much sense in 2017. This idea that when you enter into a contract with another person, you do so on relatively equal footing, you can hash out the terms, and you go forward and go your separate ways as equal satisfied parties. That is no longer the case. Basically, the more and more you have software getting into everything, you have the rise of click wrap contracts, where you have to agree to a contract that, unless you're a total nerd, like me, you have never read the iTunes agreement. I guarantee you. You know, there are all kinds of experiments where people put things in there. There's a provision in the iTunes user license agreement which prevents you from using the software in the development of nuclear weapons. That's in there, and no one reads it. So my point is that we have this idea in this sort of like very abstracted universe that we as individuals should be able to negotiate away the privacy and certain information in order to receive services. And this is like what underpins the concept of using things like Google and Facebook. We get a free service, and in exchange we let them do some stuff with our data. The problem is that there is no balance anymore.
Hang on one second.
Yeah.
You just hit a key topic. Mm-hmm. You said a free service.
Right.
There is no such thing.
Free. I mean, free in scare quotes. It is free in exchange for the use of our data. So we are paying for it. We're just paying for it a different way. Now, there's this like sort of free market idealism that says like people are perfectly informed. Like they know, you know, when you go to Facebook, they're going to harvest all your data. It's like, well, my mother doesn't understand that when you Google something, Google has that search result forever. And they have tied it to your IP address, and they probably know where you live, and they've tied it to all this other stuff, which is why shortly after I announced to my parents that I was expecting their first grandchild, all of a sudden they started getting mailing advertisements for diapers at their house, which I have never lived at. So the point is that like, what constitutes informed consent when you're talking about trading away your data? And your private data. Where do you draw that line? Is it, well, you're using Google, so you should know that they're keeping all of your data? Is it, you're posting all this stuff to Facebook, so a rational person would know that they're keeping all of your data? Is it, you know, who looks at a vibrator and thinks, I have to worry about this thing, you know, socking away the temperature of my pelvic floor on a server farm in Palo Alto? Like, who thinks about that? And so the question is, like, where do you draw that line of what constitutes informed trading away of your data and what does not. So that's just kind of like, that's an underlying theme running through a lot of this stuff.
So I'm a lot of different types of nerd, and one of the different types of nerd I am is a legal nerd, and I'm enough of that nerd to want to clarify something for the audience, just because I think it's important. The U.S. does have a right to privacy. It's in the Fourth Amendment. We do not have a right to data protection. So our right to privacy is vis-a-vis the government, what they can and cannot collect and do with our data. Unlike Europe, we do not have a right in what companies can collect or do with our data. That is not a right that we have. This is a right we may be able to have one day if we push hard enough for it. But we don't have it now. We can't even pass a federal data breach notification law, and we have to piggyback on 50 different laws, 50 different states that make companies confused and users confused, and nobody knows when their data has been breached by whatever company. Big problem. And so I really thought there was a clarification for everybody about where we can exercise our rights in the country and where we can't. I think there's that question.
Warren Ellis brought this up to his mailing list recently, which is how I heard about it, but an internet-connected lock company folded and left a bunch of dead locks lying around. A lock company isn't going to collect much data aside from unlocked at 5:06 p.m. However, a vibrator company can gather so much more personal information. Is there a case of an Internet of Things company that is folding, selling their data as an asset, as part of bankruptcy, or trading it away? And is there a community response, perhaps in the medical community, to blacklist somebody who tries to buy it? Has anything like that occurred?
Yes, actually. And so, yes, and so let me actually speak to that. In our future, you guys are going to have something to weigh in on. Remember, when you do business with a corporate entity, a business entity, they own your data as an asset. Regardless of who it is, data has value. On average, the last estimation I saw was that on an annual basis, our data is worth $6,100 per year per human being on the planet. That's mailing lists, that's the grocery store, that's your loyalty cards, that's all that sort of stuff. So if somebody comes in and goes bankrupt, their data is usually the most valuable asset that is left. And it tends to be someone comes in to buy that. What they're buying tends to be the mailing list to try to sell them the new services for the new provider that bought the company. I'm not aware of anybody that did that with sex toys, but it will happen. I mean, it's because, and that happens with mergers every day. It may not be because of a bankruptcy. It may just simply be because he builds the better toy, the better device, the better protection, and somebody comes in and buys it. His EULA says, I'm not going to store your personal information. The new company that comes in the door that buys it, that is, you know, all right, I'll be nice. Anyway, the new company that comes in and buys it changes the EULA. Are you going to read that? You didn't read the first one. You're not going to read the new one that says, oh, by the way, we're sharing your orgasm data with Amazon because you, like, need to get this new product. The good news is the majority of data that gets sold in this country is around what else can I sell you. The bad news is the majority of data that gets shared in this country is what can I sell you. And that involves politics.
I believe the first company that did this was actually, who has PreCheck? TSA PreCheck? There used to be a private company that offered this called Clear. Back in 2009, they went bankrupt and they tried to sell all of their personal data of all of the passengers that they had pre-vetted to bypass TSA security. They were banned from selling some of it, but not all of it, I believe.
Though there are still some Clear stations.
Yeah. Yes.
In DC, right. Especially.
I think it's worthwhile. Something I worked on several years ago was a data aggregator. I was in consulting with them. They were going under, and the company I was working for at the time, we came in and did some consulting with them. The data aggregator had the financial names, usernames, email addresses, and passwords for all of the different banking services that these people used. They went and sold, there was not a question, through the acquisition, they sold all of that information, which again was the keys to the personal kingdom of all the people that were online. And the problem is when that happens, you can change a password, but the amount of other personal data that was collected about those individuals and how that then got sold to the purchaser about the profiles of all those individual people, data is data. Once it exists, it does not go away.
Press box. There you go.
I was just curious, you told me that, or you said that you had one of the devices
yes.
that had
yes.
the big scandal. Did you have it before or after the big scandal?
Before.
Before, awesome.
Yep.
Do you consider it to be worth the risk? Like, what, at this point, it's getting to where it would just be, like, ridiculous to even consider buying one. Just get a normal vibrator and go without the orgasm graph.
It did a lot more than that.
Oh.
But it didn't do me any good.
It wasn't for you. I think it comes down to personal choice, right? It should be noted that WeVibe, if memory serves me correct, and Amy, correct me if I'm wrong, they did not admit any wrongdoing. They settled out of court, or settled the settlement, I should say. And what they said was that they were collecting the data for product development, right? So if their user base were using the vibrators on the highest setting on a continuous basis, then obviously they need to re-engineer them to for more options and whatnot. And a lot of this data that's collected out there is for product development and marketing. My first data warehouse project at a very, very large cable company was based on
how much porn you were selling.
How much porn you guys were watching. And also, when did you stop? When did you fast forward? All of that information went into a data warehouse, and they didn't even know what to do with the data at the time. They're like, we just want this. And I was like, why? And they're like, because we're gonna use it for marketing one day. And eventually, right now, they do collect all of that data. Because the hardware now is cheap. And so we can. But yeah, I think it comes down to personal choice. I don't really care who knows about my orgasms, but you know, but I also do something that's a little different for a living than most people. I have clients that would be mortified if the information came out, if anyone even knew that they had a vibrator, much less than anything else. You go back to like the Ashley Madison scandal, where I had people call me and how to deal with that. So it, you know, it sort of stretches personal choices.
So on top of Internet of Dongs, has anybody heard of Internet of Shit? It's another website I will absolutely plug. It is all the IoT devices that, why do you think, exist. I think it is about choice, but it's also about personal decision making. What is the best for you? And there are some people who travel a lot for work who this matters to their relationship. There are cam girls out there who sell access to their connected vibrators as a personal commodity. This might be worth it for them. Again, judgment-free zone. That's their choice. There are people who actually use this who are recovering from fairly heinous sex crimes and who use it as a recovery device to sensitize their way back to having physical contact. And it might be worth it for them. It actually might specifically not be worth it for them, because if they get hacked and victimized again, that might be the end of the road. And so it really is, you need to know the risk, but you need to make your own decisions.
It really does go back to that awareness thing and being really conscious of what's out there and making the decision for yourself.
And I'm going to jump in just as play tech guy for a minute. And I think everybody has said it. You have to make an informed decision as a consumer. And that's not just about these devices. That's about everything. Because no matter what, if it's connected, somebody is collecting that data. If somebody has sold you a product, somebody's collecting that data. As we go forward, and tomorrow night we're going to be talking about the evolution of sex tech, what's coming next, the new fun toys. So that's an invitation to come back tomorrow night. But anyway, as we look at this from a privacy standpoint, we're looking at a very core, very personal, very primal issue for all of us, which involves sex. But at the same time, it involves every aspect of our lives, because the people that play with our money, Amazon sells 70% of the books that are sold right now. They have a very direct impact on what I sell and what I move in terms of a lot of my product. From a fiction standpoint, I can get a tremendous amount of data from them as to who I want to market to and who I want to sell to. The good news is this, from a privacy standpoint, the majority of the data is not about you as an individual. It's about you as a market. There's a great deal of anonymity there. So while I push a lot of paranoia about privacy and everything else, the good news is, get what the hell you want, do what the hell you want to do, and if somebody gets the data, because somebody has it, don't worry about it.
So we're in our last like 8 minutes. I know there's a question here, because he has the mic. There's a question down here in the front in the red shirt. And there was a question in the back. Yep, I knew it was back there. If we can take all three at once, and I will take note of all of them, and we'll answer all three of them, I promise.
Assuming I'm sufficiently scared at this point.
If not, we haven't done our jobs. Yeah.
We've talked about how companies are motivated by money and that sort of thing. They're also motivated by legal, regulatory, and compliance. Which is also ultimately about money. But is that the real ultimate solution to this problem? Like, if consumers can't be educated sufficiently because it's a complex technical topic, do we have to rely on a law or regulation solution?
Down here in the front.
I think my question sort of goes to the same topic. Full disclosure, I am legal counsel for one of those evil empire companies, very large, multinational U.S. company. And I can tell you that you know, my question is, because you talked about the European framework. I mean, fundamentally, this comes down to the fact in this country that we don't believe that we have ownership of our data. In Europe, it's a fundamental right that I, as a consumer, own my data. And I can tell you that as a company, the way that impacts my clients is we think very carefully about how we implement solutions, you know, how we go into new countries, how we protect that data. So my question to you would be, you know, sitting in the position you are as a regulator, and this dovetails into his question, how do you go about changing what seems to be a very fundamental difference in the way Americans view this versus Europe and much of the rest of the world?
And then,
just toss in the crowd and we'll just like glue it
in. Who has the beach ball?
I'm pretty okay at volleyball.
We've talked a lot about hacking as a risk and marketing as a threat that companies can perform. I'd like to understand the bounds of the risk and opportunity due to the companies collecting this data. What's the best thing that you think that the companies can do with this data? And what's the worst thing that you think the companies can do with this data?
All right, so the three questions are there legal and regulatory solutions? How do you bridge the EU-US gap? And what is the best slash worst thing that companies can do with data? We'll start with Meredith and go down.
Oh boy. So that first one's a biggie and what we spend a lot of time thinking about at my job. The answer is like the way that the US has the way that our regulatory framework in the US has developed is that we have essentially balkanized responsibility for privacy issues among a bunch of different agencies based on subject matter. So the FCC historically has authority to do privacy about telecommunications services, and then you have HHS, which does HIPAA, and then you have all other different kinds, and then you have the FTC, which is like privacy as enshrined in contracts with consumers and consumer protection, deceptive practices kind of stuff. So I think fundamentally, to sort of jump onto the question about the EU-US gap, there's got to be a way to meet in the middle. If anyone has figured that out, I would like to meet them and buy them several beers. Because
I'll
that
take
would
a
be,
beer.
That, you already had two. Yeah, because that would make my job a lot easier. Fundamentally, I think I heard it phrased once very succinctly by a professor of mine who framed it as, in the United States, Americans are concerned about their government knowing too much about them, and they don't really care too much about their neighbors knowing too much about them. In Europe, people are deeply concerned about their neighbors knowing too much about them, and they don't really care too much if their government knows too much about them. So it's kind of an inverse.
But they do care about the U.S. government.
Yes, they do. Everyone should care about the U.S. government, material.
You should care about your government, period.
Yes. So the short version is, I think that there is now a push, definitely, to get a more comprehensive, like, intellectual approach to privacy, even if that doesn't mean, like, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean we are going to create a privacy regulator and they are going to handle all the privacy. Because frankly, you have different issues depending on what kind of field you're in. Like, it's just, they're gonna present a host of different problems. IoT, connected vibrators, and my doctor accidentally sending me home with someone else's paperwork, two very different, but related sets of concerns. I think that there is a push to start thinking about privacy more holistically and start maybe bridging that gap a little bit as to what that is gonna end up looking like. I think it's anybody's guess.
There are 4 minutes left. JD and Jim, split them between you.
Okay. I'm just going to say, what can you do with the data that's positive? And I think this goes back to product development, for me, at least, because I do think that there has been a significant improvement in the sex toy market because of some of that data that has been collected. And I think I'm very excited that there's so many female founders that are coming into this space. Number one, because I'm all about women in tech, yay, whatever type it is. And B, I just think it's an opportunity for women to really step into their owning their sexual nature.
For me, it all still goes back to making a conscious decision. You know, privacy is very key to me, but we live in a world where that's dead in many, many ways. We now have to live in a world where privacy is built because our data is merged in with so many others. We know this about all of our other behaviors. The data that's collected on us in so many ways, again, I go back to get what you want, get what you need, and understand there's a certain anonymity there, but at the same time, there's a certain level of data there. Make a conscious decision.
Just FYI, there's a great bill by Senator Warner on IoT security. Just incentivizes good practices, not trying to regulate. Go look at it if you're looking interested in legal solutions. If I knew the answer to your question, I would make a lot more money. And the answer to the best or worst practices, we have booths over in the corner. We're by the cardboard TARDIS. I will talk to you at length about it tomorrow if you want to come ask.
And the only thing I would ask is, or comment on it says, I work in a very heavily regulated industry. I've dealt with medical data, I've dealt with financial data most of my career. No matter what the standard is, it's not the level you think it is. And just because something says it feels good, I am very heavily regulated. I deal a lot in my day world with financial data, trading data, day trading. Just because it sounds good and feels good, I've dealt a great deal with HIPAA. Just because it sounds good and feels good, isn't it?
And if you're in the security industry, what a wonderful opportunity you have to go out and reach out to some of these companies for consulting, because I can tell you they need it.
Join me in thanking the panelists, thanking the volunteers.